Welcome to the CEN Show, a platform where we learn from the world community. I'm your host, Rasaki Maskani. And on the panel this evening, we have Professor Amin Ra, Ernest McBride Jr., Joe Hembrick, Brother Ahi, and Dr. Jarita. Our guest for this evening is Dr. Leslie Renee Cornegay. Dr. Leslie Renee Cornegay is an executive leader, scholar, practitioner, and an author whose work bridges lived experiences, institutional leadership, and cultural intelligence. She currently serves as executive director of University Environmental Services at Duke University and as a faculty member at Langston University and Champlain College, where she teaches leadership, marketing, professional communication, and organizational change. She is the author of Leading to Change the World, One Black Woman's Journey into Positions of Leadership in Predominantly White Institutions, a deeply reflective and practice-centered work that chronicles her ascent through complex institutional system as often the first and at times the only Black woman in executive spaces. The book is more than memoir. It is leadership text grounded in lived navigation of power, race, gender, identity, and strategic influence. In Leading to Change the World, Dr. Cornegay examine visibility, resilience, cultural intelligence, and executive presence, not as abstract theories, but as lived realities. She writes from the terrain of real-world complexity, negotiating scrutiny, managing perception, balancing excellence with exhaustion, and building credibility in spaces where belonging is never assumed. The book challenges the notion that advancement alone signals success and instead reframes leadership as both an interior discipline and an institutional responsibility. Her scholarship does not separate theory from practice. Rather, her leadership frameworks, including redshift moments, confidence circles, and structural reflective models, emerged directly from the experiences documented in her book. These frameworks equip leaders to navigate predominantly white institutions, manage identity in high-stake environments, build coalitions across difference, and sustain excellence without losing self. A nationally respected voice in executive resilience, systemic change, and cultural intelligence, Dr. Cornegay translates decades of operational leadership into political strategies for navigating complexities and leading with clarity and courage. Her work centers on a critical question: how do you change systems without allowing them to change you? Beyond the academy, she extends her mission through Cornegay Consulting and Cornegay Foundation, advancing educational access, mentorship, youth development, and women's leadership initiatives. Her life's work reflects the central premise of her book: leadership is not about position alone, it is about impact, integrity, and the courage to remain whole while transforming the institution you serve. Dr. Cornegay continues to challenge individuals and organizations alike to live well, lead well, and change the world. That is an excellent observation of our guest this evening. And I had a chance to read her book, and the book is excellent. Especially I enjoyed the parts where she talked about her upbringing and throughout her life and things that she was doing. It's just great to see that people like her have resilience and push forward to make it to places where most people don't go. So I appreciate you coming on, sharing with us this evening, Dr. Leslie Renee Cornegay. So I have two questions for you. Well, before that, is there anything else that you want to add to that, you know, very exceptional bio that I read?
I think that it covers it. What I will say is that, good evening, everybody, that my career path was not the normative. It wasn't traditional. I didn't go from high school to college, that sort of thing. And so it's been a process and a journey that, I talk quite a bit about in the book, but I think just the journey itself, not finishing the first degree until I was 38, that's really when I started the scholarship. And that, that kind of started the journey for the master's, the doctorate, and doing the scholarly work. That's about it.
Okay. Well, there were two things I found interesting in the book. Mm-hmm. And I look at feminism as a divisive type of term, but womanism is something different mm-hmm. than that. So can you expound on that, womanism, that term?
So I think the difference with womanism is that it embraces our not only women, but men as well. I think traditional feminism it kind of sets divides between male and female. But womanism embraces that. It also embraces the platinum rule, which is treating people the way that they want to be treated, not necessarily the way that you would want to be treated, but within the constraints of whatever environment that you are in.
Okay. And the other term that I didn't even know about it until I read it in the book, other mothering. Can you speak about that and how it relates to, I guess it's something related to leadership style?
Mm-hmm.
Other mothering?
So I think what you're referring to is hold on a minute. It's just been a while. Well, Patricia Hill Collins is the one that framed that. And it's rooted in the Black feminism thought. And it just describes the tradition of Black women caring for, mentoring and protecting and advocating for children and communities that are not biologically theirs. And so other mothering that I talk about in the book is really around, oftentimes Black female leaders are thrust into that role. We're seen as not only the leader, but as the mother of that group. And so another example that I talk about in the book is I had a Ghanaian employee that I had worked with that started out as a frontline employee, and I saw the potential and, encouraged him to, along with resources, to, progress through our tracks at the time. And some people would say that it's mentoring. Some people would say that it's coaching. I saw it as an opportunity to help people that look like me be able to progress. So reaching back, pulling up, where I'm not, I don't feel that, based on my own experience and what I've seen, that that happens a lot for us. But one of the things that he did that really honed for me what I was doing is that on one of his trips when he went to Ghana, he actually brought back a statue for me, and it was of a mother and child. And he said to me that that is how he felt about my leadership. That I, and that the mother was lifting the child. He said that those of us that want to grow, you lift us and you help us to grow.
That's excellent.
And so that for me, something like that is really gratifying to hear that. And then for him to take the initiative to do something like he did, I mean, that is something that's been, I cherish that.
Yeah, we have Dr. Sherita on, and she's from Ghana. Well,
Okay.
not from Ghana, but she lives in Ghana. So that's that was interesting. Now you work at Langston as a professor, and then what's I had a problem with, as you can see, pronouncing that other college's the other college name. How do you
Sure.
pronounce that college name?
Champlain College.
Champlain.
Like champagne.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, where is that located?
That's in Burlington, Vermont.
Vermont. Okay. And
So I,
you're
yeah,
currently at both colleges, right?
yes, I lived in Burlington for 10 years. And so that's where that connection comes from.
Okay. So how do you like being a professor?
I love it. I teach graduate students for the most part, and they're a lot like I was in terms of seeking further education and trying to do all of the adult things that we need to do, which is working and taking care of families and things like that, but still having that desire to do more. And I learned just as much from them as they learned from me because they're in all fields, they're all over the world. And it's been a really good fit for me.
Well, you seem to be doing a lot of things here. Now, can you tell us about what do you do exactly at Duke University?
So at Duke University, I lead a department of a little over 200 employees now. It used to be closer to three. And we provide all of the majority of the services for the university. And so I work with the most marginalized group on campus.
Okay. All right. Well, let me go to the panel and see if they have any questions or comments. Professor Ra?
Appreciate what you asked, if I understand correctly. And again, welcome, Dr. Carnegie.
Thank you.
And we When you dealing with being on a white campus, what are some of the issues you find? And I'm thinking you're talking about black with people on a predominantly white campus.
Exactly.
Okay, and what do you find are the major issues or challenges that you would write the book or deal with that as an issue?
I've worked at a number of institutions, publicly white institutions, in my career. And I think the things are pretty universal for frontline staff. Things tend to get political. And so politics plays a very big role in what happens. And when I say politics, it's, some of the organizations had unions. Some did not. I would say that there are very few people that look like me in the senior leadership roles right now, and it's been like this probably for the last 20 years. I have been like the third person from the president in terms of that level. And you don't see too many of us there on the academic nor operational side of the university. So for me, what I found is it being the only one or the first one, and being tapped to represent in terms of committees and things like that, when DEI was strong, I would say that it hasn't completely gone away. People have figured out how to, if they really care. Institutions have figured out how to ensure that equity and inclusion still happens. It's just different words now. But I would say those would be the biggest things. I've found the role that I have been in has been an advocate for the group that I serve as a leader. And that means going, advocating for what I know is right to support the team, or going up against and standing firm against things that I don't agree with that have been directed over the group from senior leadership. From executive leadership.
Well, I mean, so you're talking about being an employee at a predominantly white school as a professional, a professor or administrator. Is that what you're saying? You're not
So,
focusing on the student, you're focusing on the professional.
right, I'm focusing on the operational, the executive director position. Coming up through the ranks as a leader in predominantly white institutions. In terms of academia and working as an adjunct, I have to be honest, I haven't had that many issues. Now it may be different for people that, and I've read this when I did my research around tenure. And
Promotion,
yeah, we weren't always treated
retention, tenure, and promotion.
right. And even now, there are some schools that have, well, I say schools, some systems, or states that are following the federal mandate. And unless you are a research one tier school, They're just doing away with tenure. Like, if you have tenure already, they're not taking it away from you. But if you can't recruit anybody new or promote anybody if they are aspiring to be a tenured faculty at a non-tier one school. So there are some systems that are already doing that. The other thing is, there are in this new administration some disciplines that have been designated as not professional. And one of those, because I have a niece that's studying to be a nurse, nursing is not considered professional anymore.
Did they propose that, or did it ever go through?
Oh, it went through.
Because I didn't hear that it went through yet. I thought the Nurses Association was fighting all of
It hasn't stopped
that. I mean, that's in some places, but
Yeah. It
they
hasn't stopped the financial aid.
okay. Well, it's difficult being a registered nurse anyway. I mean, it's a challenge, a prerequisite just to get in the nursing program and go through it. But anyway, let me get back to this. Okay, so did you ever have problems getting promotions or getting hired or serving on committees, the academic senate or the so-called what are the committees, the academic? That's the main one, the academic senate. But I mean, have you? I mean, you not? They don't let you serve on those things, or they don't let black people serve on them if that's hired there.
I have often been tapped to serve on different level committees for senior level positions. But that has also helped me become savvy in interviewing and knowing what to ask for.
Oh yeah, you got to know the system in order to be able to navigate your way through
Right.
it. But I'm trying to see, have you had or know people in your research that because I think the concept of your book and stuff is, being on a predominantly white in a predominantly white institution. What is the difference? Let's say, for instance, between Langston, you over there, Langston, what is the difference between Langston and let's say Carnegie or whichever the college you were talking about?
I think the difference is at one, I have a men I have sought mentorship. So the first opportunity teaching at Langston, I mean at Champaign College, this was my first experience before I got the doctorate. I knew that was something I wanted to do, and so I made an appointment. I was very, and still am, what is the word I want to use? I would reach out and seek an audience once I found out who the people were that were making the decisions, and so that I could have a one-on-one with them. And it just so happened the dean of the online college and her chair decided to meet with me. And I think it was probably more out of curiosity than anything else. And I actually went in there and talked them into giving me an opportunity to teach. And I was one of the first black people to do that in terms of the adjunct back then. And I actually ended up being really good friends with them over the years. And that's how I have been able to continue to, leave Vermont and then work out of state and still teach. At Langston, I would say that the dean is a sponsor and not a mentor. He puts you in positions that help you to excel. I've never had that before. And I talk about that in my book. That's the difference that I see. There's a lot of talk about mentoring, but who is actually in a position to help you grow? To put, position opportunities or knowing people. And in terms of the role as a executive leader, that is one of the things that I always wanted to be able to do was to reach back and help people because I didn't have that.
Are you trying to be a president of a college?
I have thought about that. I don't, that pathway, I haven't quite figured that one out yet. Because
When you say executive administrator, you're right up under them. That's a challenge. Okay. I appreciate your answers. All right, go
What
ahead.
I say though is a president, the president is they raise the money
Oh,
for the
yeah.
institution. I would rather run the institution. So I would rather be a
Vice President.
right the or the executive vice president because that's real a bit of the finance department because they're the ones that are running the university.
Okay. Thanks, Professor Rao. Ernest, question, comment?
Well, not really, because it just kind of reminded me she when she talked about mentoring people. Well, I kind of came up. Well, I was always in the sports, played every sport and was pretty good at it, like you and Ra were in basketball. I got scholarship offers and a couple of pro offers in football, but I started a youth track team, and that enabled me to mentor a lot of youths because we would take kids from 5 years old up to 18. Usually we till the time they get in high school and we let them go. Well, you got another coach in the high school and you go with them, but we still had the track team going to Long Beach Sprinters. And that gave me an opportunity because we would at least two or three times a year, we'd take the kids out of state, get a charter bus, take them out for overnight, the weekend to do track meets like in Arizona and in Oregon. We'd take them up to Oregon every other year and try to teach them how to behave in restaurants and how to use the knives and forks and all that, like basic, skills. And then I noticed I've been out of that now since 1990. I kind of gave it up. And I see kids now, they're grown and they got kids and they see me on the street and Coach McBride, man, and it's just a great feeling. They remember me, what I did for them. And then the other day, I went to an all-comers meet at Long Beach Poly and met a couple of parents there, and they always remembered me. And their kids have kids because they're there with grandkids now. And so that was always a great feeling for me, and that's one ex couple experiences in my life that I really cherish,
Yep,
so
being
that's
able to
all
impact. Yeah, being able to impact young lives and they in a good position after you dealt with them, that makes you feel real good that you was a part of that. Thank you. Hembrick.
Evening, everyone.
Hello.
Appreciate you, Dr. Leslie. A couple of questions. This University of Champaign, is that a black college?
It's predominantly white.
Okay. Have you ever worked in Connecticut around University of Hartford?
No, I have not.
Friend of mine's wife is in the dean's position now. One of his sisters have crossed paths.
Okay.
Yeah, but just like Mr. McBride, a former coach myself for about 20 years, trying to gear our boys into becoming men and good citizens and good fathers and whatnot. It's always gratifying when you run across them. I'm kind of like Ra. I can't go nowhere where I don't know nobody. They holler at my name from across the way. But it's good to see them progress, and it's good to see them using some of the same philosophical stuff I taught them that they teach their kids, their grandkids. That's always good. I can imagine what you've gone through trying to nigger your way through these white institutions. A friend of mine is over undergraduate admissions out here at LMU. He's a Cal State LA graduate, and they've been trying to get him out of there because of the large number of black students that he brings in every year. And another question, at these institutions that you work at, what's the percentage of black students that attend there, if you have any kind of a figure? You say that you work with the marginal group. What's the ratio?
I will say there was a conservative approach to attracting domestic blacks as opposed to people that were from another country. Because in terms of the numbers, we're all the same, right? And so you had a high percentage of international students, coming in from different countries, as opposed to domestic blacks, people within the United States being recruited for. I know at Champaign College there was a, and the University of Vermont, it was a several initiatives to really attract more African American students. And same thing at Duke. I've seen that even in terms of giving scholarships. Even with the federal mandate, and the same thing has happened at Harvard too, and MIT. Like they'd rather just, even though they're getting heavily penalized, their missions really haven't changed in terms of bringing the education to the masses. So I think. I read somewhere like Harvard, they were giving free scholarships or free to households of 200,000. That's not poverty level. So, but I know that that is not everywhere, right? You don't have that happening in higher ed in some of the schools, depending on what state it is. So.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Brother Ahe.
Thank you, brother. In spite of Black women being the most educated demographic and only comprising, say, 2% or 3% of the adjunct professors in America, and the current climate and the attack on higher education from this administration, can you tell us how that affects you currently and people like you, and what do you see in the future?
Well, I haven't really been impacted. I think maybe systems that I manage have been impacted, and I've had to manage that. But personally, I have not been impacted. But what I do see in the future is the way that I came through, I don't know that that's going to be possible for those coming behind me, just by the way that some of the things have been dismantled. For an example, I never really felt that I was a affirmative action kid, right? I never felt like I came up that way. But now that I look back, I think some of those opportunities I might have gotten through the door simply because there were so many boxes they were trying to check. And even though I was overqualified most of the time, we tend to have need to be overqualified to even get there. So, I don't know what it's going to look like for those coming behind us or behind me in any profession. I think that's why we have so many entrepreneurs now. People just going, making a decision that they're not going to work for somebody else. They'd rather develop it themselves.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Brother Ali. Dr. Sharita?
Peace and love, family. Peace to you, sister. I'm very grateful that you're sharing your experience tonight, because being a woman and a Black woman in leadership role in America and even in the world is not easy. I can say it's not hard either, because I know your journey, you learn a lot of lessons and you learn what to do and what not to do. And you sound like you deal with, instead of looking at somebody as a position or white man, white woman, Black woman, whatever, you're looking at them as a person and dealing with them people to people. I feel like that's how you survived to the position that you're in right now. So I'm just kind of listening because I need to build more tolerance as a woman in leadership position with a lot of responsibilities. I think that's what draw me to tonight too, because it's like so many different tasks, so many different things and people that you're responsible for. And the weight, can be a lot, and it can really take a toll on your health, as well. And you sacrifice a lot. And for me, I feel like you have way more tolerance than I have, because I haven't had to deal in those spaces with white people, period, let alone a white man. I mean, I knew a long time ago a white man was never going to be my boss, let alone to have a boss in the first place. My only boss was my father and my mother. That's it. I worked for the bank for a minute. I worked for Costco, and that's where I had my experience with a white man yelling at me and telling me to move faster. And I think I was 16 or 17, and I was like, oh, yeah, that this won't ever happen again. I definitely. So I'm listening to you and learning tolerance tonight. I think that's what I'm getting from this tonight. Mm-hmm. Because I'm in a position, also being in Ghana, I'm also dealing with the element of a patriarchal system. I've been there 20 years. I have citizenship there and everything. And I'm in business there. And I have taken some leadership roles, in certain organizations where I've been asked to come, not necessarily, sought it out. And I find myself a lot of times in the room with nothing but Ghanaian men, period.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is a woman, she's serving food or she's taking some kind of notes. And then at the end, after everybody's getting together talking, then the women want to complain about stuff. And I was like, why don't you say it in a meeting? Like, why don't you bring it up? And they'll come say it to me because the Black American with the big mouth from Compton is going to say something. Mm-hmm. I'm going to bring it up. I'm going to, bring it to the table. And, when I do it in a certain way, but you do find yourself in the position where you have to just defend yourself as a woman first before they even see what you're even bringing to the table. So I think I learned to read the room, do my homework on people before I meet them. And then in Ghana, I move with another person. I don't meet men one-to-one in business, or I'll meet them with another woman or with another man.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just what I learned in my experience. And that's there in Ghana. It's a whole different thing in LA.
Right. A
whole different position in LA. So, yeah. So I'm like you said, tonight I'm learning tolerance because I know I wouldn't be able to move in some of those spaces that you've been moving in. And I just want to know, I guess it's even a question, is that how did you build up the tolerance? Just from my own observation, I'm saying from my own observation, but from your own experience, how did you build up the tolerance?
Well, one of the things that I talk about is in the book, part of the how I was brought up, I was a military child, and we moved constantly within the United States and outside of the United States. And, I learned very quickly to, never say goodbye and to be able to go into a completely different kind of environment and navigate through that successfully. But in doing that, I learned that, it's like the same characters always showed up. You just had to figure out who was who. And, just having that from childhood, when I went into, adult landscapes, my career, school, that sort of thing, it really prepared me to be able to, so one of the things I talk about in the book is developing your own confidence circle. So everywhere that I've gone, I've always found out who was who and who had power, right? Not that I wanted to necessarily ask for favors, but if I ever needed one, those would be the people that I would need to go to. And I will tell you, within predominantly white institutions and leading white people, I have had some situations where my leadership was challenged. And challenged to the point where every place that I might have would have wanted to go to advocate, because you know they were so derogatory and so accusatory just because you held them accountable for something, that it was compromised. I know one particular incident, I stayed on administrative review for like almost 5 years. Can you imagine how stressful that was? And had all of my direct reports called into the auditor's office to investigate. Through the investigation was about my leadership and whether or not what I was accused of was true or not. And so even though I knew that I was perfectly innocent, right? I always covered my tracks in terms of anything that I say once, I can say twice. And so I was always vindicated. This happened a couple of times in Vermont. This happened at my current institution. And it's really because I developed these confidence circles to have people to go to talk to, so that, you know, I even though they couldn't necessarily take care of the problem for me, they could help to be an ear for me to vent or whatever. So I think that's really been what has, for me, been beneficial. And what I found is these people don't always have to be in my direct industry or, you know, feel, you know, do what I do, but they are influential people, you know, within the institution. In higher ed, it's very, like I said earlier, it's very political. It's all about who knows who. And you never know who knows who. And who can influence different people.
And who knows you, too.
Exactly. Yeah. So, the confidence circles, who you surround yourself with, is very important. I can remember going in for, I call it an interrogation, in an auditor's office. And I mean, I've never been taken in by the police, but it had to, I've seen it on TV. And, you know, I think to the average person, it would have been very intimidating to go through something like that. But I was very calm because I knew I hadn't done anything. All of this was made up. Like being on a stage.
Wow. Well, that's, yeah, that's you. I'm just thinking about how I would have handled several things you're talking about, but yeah, I'm learning tolerance. Thank you.
I will also say that I found out in my research that a lot of Black people in higher ed have gone through things like that. And they didn't survive, right? They were, and like people that were deans and stuff like that. So, and it's mentioned in the book, I believe. at least two incidents that I found. So, you know, in some ways on the academic side for Black women that have tried to, you know, aspire to be beyond or to even be tenured faculty and beyond, that has been circumvented by people who had ulterior motives and wanted to keep them out of those roles.
Wow.
That's heavy. That's heavy.
Thanks, Dr. Sharia. I must say that for you to make it through when going through these types of things, it just shows the character that you have. And that's, you know, having integrity and doing things in the correct manner. Or if you did do something that wasn't, you know, on the up and up, at least you was able to hide it or something. But yeah, very interesting.
Rashi, and, Chief?
Yes.
Are there any Black males at the schools you at that had the same problems or different problems? Or they were able to progress easier than you as a woman?
I think they had similar, they had problems, but, you know, we have a double bind, Black women. We're Black and we're women. And I think, you know, you all tell me if you have that same experience where you're Black and you're males. So males in our society have a different privilege than women have held. And I've often had that, asked myself that, you know, when I was, before I left North Carolina the first time, was I having issues in terms of my problems being able to aspire to other positions because I was a woman, or was it because I was Black? This was when I was in the South. And I figured out now, I think it was because more being from the South, it was more, excuse me, it was both of them, but it was more that I was a woman. Whereas up North, I think they're a little bit more liberal around women, but the racism is a little bit different in that they try to intellectualize it. At least in the South, they'll tell you they don't like you.
Yeah, covert and overt.
Yeah.
Is that it, Professor Rob?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We didn't went through the whole panel. Is there anything else you want to tell us about the book and your experience before we leave this evening? Oh, what, you got something, Joe?
Can you show the book? Can you show the book?
Yes. Joe, you have something?
I got a question. One more question.
Okay.
In your path, have you conversed, did any research or had any relationships with similar people in your position that were at HBCUs, and how political is that compared to, you know, there similar politics involved or whatnot?
Yeah, I just think it comes down to the individual, because the you know it's just corruption everywhere. but I have had people that have not had very good experiences at HBCUs, and it was either working under a black male or working under a black female. And I talked in the book about working under both and my experiences. You know, we sometimes don't want to see each other rise. Or we want to be the only ones, that sort of stuff. But that's a little bit different than just outright racism.
Right.
The crabs in the bucket.
We call that tribalism in Ghana.
either you're not the right Greek freak, so to speak, with the sororities and fraternities and all that old kind of rhythm.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. So is there anything else you want to leave us with, Dr. Carnegie?
Well, you know, in the book, I close with, well, let me start over. When I wrote the book, one of the things that I was trying to do was have a resource for those coming behind me. But also what I was hearing from some of the other generations who were out in the workforce and experiencing similar things. And I thought, wow, that's not new, you know? And I thought, okay, well, at least I can write about what I know about and it can be a resource. So that is why, one of the reasons why I wrote the book. That's it. I had another thought, but I can't remember it.
Okay. Well, we appreciate your time and your work and your accomplishments. And just keep up the great work. Hopefully we can get you back on here on a future show and talk about something related to leadership. And just appreciate you coming and spending this time with us.
Well, I appreciate you all inviting me, and I'd be very happy to come back anytime.
Okay, well, definitely going to do that then. All right, Professor Rock.
Yeah.
Have you secured a guest for Tuesday?
Yeah, I'm still working on Black Lives Matter, Brother Keeley, or either Dr. Lavina Abdullah, who's the chair of the L.A. chapter. And I'll double check tomorrow and call you.
Okay. So next Wednesday, we have Dr. Charles Alexander, the level set. He'll be here, and the topic is Why Black History. So we're going to conclude Black History Month with that question on next Wednesday. And then we have Roots Reggae Reasoning Sessions. We have Fabian Cook. Fabian Cook is, I think he's an exceptional engineer. I know he worked with Ziggy Marley, or he still works with Ziggy Marley, and amongst other famous reggae artists, and probably even out of the genre of reggae. But we have him on Thursday of next week. All right, folks. Thank you. Thank everybody for coming. And, Dr. Carnegie, can't wait till next time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good night, everybody.
Right. Each one teach one in Conscious Corner.
All right.
Continue to have a great day.
Goodbye.
Bye.